How many cops, cameras, and other surveillance gear do you get for $1 billion? Well, Vancouver residents are finding out the answer. That's because $1 billion is the security budget for the 2010 Winter Games. Joining us to help make sense of the unfolding Olympic security regime is local anti-Olympic activist and UBC professor Chris Shaw. Chris is the author of the book Five Ring Circus, Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
My pleasure.
What do they mean by security? What are they spending all this money on? Who are they keeping safe from what kind of threats?
Those are very good questions. When you decide to host the Olympic Games, the Pandora's box opens, and what happens is that you become afraid of everything. And that's essentially what's happened here. The Olympic security forces have decided that essentially everything is a threat. And when they first tried to define it a few years ago, it was based on sort of a Munich-like scenario, that something would happen that would be terrorist-based. And so they had initially estimated that the terrorist threat would be medium to low, and that they weren't worried about civil disobedience or protests, and that crime would be the next one up. And that changed in the last couple of years when they began to realize that there was a resistance and there was going to be protests in the streets. So they've now changed their evaluation, and now even though they think foreign terrorism is low, crime seems to have fallen off the radar, but they are now deathly concerned about protests, because protests have the potential to embarrass the city and the various levels of government for the things they haven't done, and the IOC hates that and, in fact, writes it into the host city agreement. There could be no demonstrations of any sort. So we have a $1 billion security apparatus that is largely security theater, because there's nothing about protests that require F-18 airplanes in the air or require helicopter gunships. These are all to impress the public that they are watching out for everyone, when in fact they can't stop the things that they ostensibly are there to stop. All they can do is now start to look intensively at dissidents and people who don't like the games. So in effect, we have a $1 billion security budget that's designed to prevent the city and the province and the federal government from being embarrassed by messy domestic protests.
$1 billion is a lot of money. You mentioned a few things, but where is most of that money going?
Well, about half of that is going to the ISU, the Integrated Security Unit, that is primarily RCMP and other police forces from across the country. An unknown amount, still to be determined, that does not seem to be in ISU's budget, is going to the Vancouver Police for the various pieces of equipment and for the policing hours that they're going to require. And roughly $500 million is going to the military, because the military is deploying something like 3,000 troops, more like 4,000 troops, and bringing in Navy frigates and aircraft and Army units and engineers and all kinds of other specialized units to deal with this whole range of things that they've now identified as threats, even though, quite honestly, the Canadian CSIS has not identified any particular threats from any kind of foreign element. So you have a military presence that's going to cost $500 million a year, probably an underestimate. You have the police presence that's probably going to cost $500 million, probably an underestimate, and an unknown amount for the Vancouver Police. So we actually have an extraordinary budget that's extraordinary only because we were told it was going to be $175 million back in 2002 when VANOC, the precursor to VANOC, which is called the BIDCOR, deliberately misled the public by underestimating the number rather wildly. And then when it finally crept out that the number was ridiculous, because every budget for security around the world for Olympic security has been well over $1 billion, they reluctantly admitted that number was probably going to go much higher, which of course it did. It's really overkill in a lot of ways. And a lot of what the ISU has been doing, as you're aware, is going around and trying to talk to activists, and in failing to talk to them, harassing their families, harassing their relatives, and going to their workplaces and things like that.
And this happened to you a couple months ago, did it not?
It happened to me as lately as a week ago. But it started rather intensively in June, carried on for quite a while during the months of June and July, and then faded away for a bit, and it came back this fall. And just last week, as I was parking in my parking garage near VGH, there was a plainclothes police officer with the Integrated Security Unit waiting behind the wheel of a black SUV. It's almost like a cliche. And as I walked out of the parkade, he was already on the street waiting for me. and wanting to talk to me about the protests, which I declined to do, but he gave me his card. And of course, the subliminal message is, we know everything about you, we know where you work, we know where you go for coffee, we know where your girlfriend lives, we know blah, 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 et cetera. And they can therefore find you anytime.
So that's kind of more their message, because they're doing this very publicly, going to visit people, and it, you see it as just a tactic of attempted intimidation?
I think it is, because if they were truly interested in information, if they were truly interested in liaison, in the first case, the information would be, they could call you up, they could send you a text message, they could do lots of things like that. If they were interested in actually dialogue with protest groups, they would hold public forums, as many people said a long time ago. Showing up at people's workplaces, showing up in front of their friends at the SkyTrain station, going to their families, this is nothing besides intimidation, or attempted intimidation. And this is probably something they learn in police school. This is policing 101. You know, the way to throw the protests off their game is to create this chill factor. People are afraid to talk to you. People may be afraid to go to your house. People may be afraid to take your leaflets or be seen talking to you. And we've had incidences in Victoria where people have come up to an ORN table and taken some leaflets to only to be approached by police outside. So it is intended to send a message. It is intended to create a chill. The good news is that it's failed to do that. It's created a backlash, and the police have had to scroll back a little bit in what they've been doing, because it really has begun to offend people. So, for example, when they tracked down my girlfriend at her school, they basically had to hack into Langara's website in order to find that information.
So they've been visiting dozens of people over the last number of months, I guess.
They have been visiting dozens of people over the last couple of months, and in fact, people all over the province. They have refused to obey a request by the lawyer for many of these people from the BCCLA, who wrote to Bud Mercer, who's the head of the ISU, and said, listen, if you want to talk to these people, you can talk through me, unless there's a crime being committed, and if you just need to speak to them, please do it through the offices of the BCCLA. The police, the RCMP, ISU laughed at that. There was actually an interview that one of them gave to Tom Sanborn, who works with the Tyee. And the officer who was speaking to him basically laughed at it. He said, we don't have to listen to that. We don't have to obey that. They can send all the letters we want. We won't respect that. So they don't. And the simple fact is they have very little respect for the charter. And they're pushing very hard into charter territory when they're doing this kind of stuff. This is the kind of stuff you expect in regimes that are far less officially respectful of civil liberties. And this is the kind of things you expect in China or in the East Germany of the day. And this is not the kind of stuff you expect in Canada.
Because of some of the bylaws and other things, you and another activist in conjunction with the BCCLA put forth a lawsuit. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, Alyssa Westergaard Thorpe and I put forward a lawsuit with BCCLA support against the city of Vancouver because of what was called the Olympic signage bylaw. And the bylaw, as it was first drafted in July 2003, was quite a charter assault. It forbade us to be in so-called celebratory zones with anything that resembled a protest sign. It forbade anything that had a stick in it, because, of course, that, in their view, that could be used as a weapon. It wouldn't allow voice amplification devices. It wouldn't allow people to leaflet or, in other words, pass out their message, because that would be considered littering, and it forbade any attempt to so-called interfere with the enjoyment of others enjoying the games. And in that sense, it was basically saying you can't protest. And at the same time, the city was saying, well, you can protest, but only in free speech areas or safe assembly areas, as they were euphemistically called. So we saw this as a charter violation, and we refused to accept that, and we launched the lawsuit. The city subsequently rewrote the law substantially, and although the new bylaw is not perfect, it is significantly better than it was before. And based on that, we decided to release the city from the lawsuit and use our energies to fight other battles.
Oh, so they made some changes to make it more legal to protest?
They made some changes to make it not illegal to protest, so let's distinguish it that way. So it is possible for people to be in the celebratory zones, it's possible for us to have signs, it's possible for us to flyer and leaflet. They have more clearly distinguished between their official fear of marketing violations versus civil disobedience and civil dissent. And so we are more confident now that the protests have a stronger footing, that it's not going to get people arrested for simply holding a sign. And they've also clarified what the marketing agreement is and what does and does not constitute a violation of the marketing agreement. So we're relatively happy that we achieved most of our goals. We didn't get them all, but the other thing we managed to do was get there was a subsection that the mayor and the city manager could change the bylaw at any time without going back to council, and we got that scrapped as well. So we're feeling fairly happy with the overall outcome. Again, not a perfect outcome, but probably as much as we could have reasonably expected.
I read somewhere that the police were saying there's all this confusion, it seems, around these sort of safe protest zones or protest pens, whatever they're calling them, and the Vancouver police seemed to say, well, we're not going to enforce that, and some other security person said, well, this is where they are, and they don't even seem to have it all clear in
there's a little confusion. Originally, the original plans that we had seen from VANOC and from ISU called for the construction of so-called safe assembly areas, which are the free speech zones, whatever those terms may mean, in at least three of the major venues. Bud Mercer, who's the head of ISU, denied that people had to use them. He said, no, they can go there if they want to be safe, which, of course, begged the question, is it not safe outside of those zones? Since then, ISU has backed off on the notion that people have to protest if they're going to protest only in those areas. The Vancouver police have basically said outright that they didn't see any reason to think people were going to go into them at all. So there was a bit of a discrepancy between the two different police agencies. The view from the ORN perspective, as I understand it, is that most of us, and I'm only speaking as an individual, we see all of Canada as a free speech zone, and we don't think we can be corralled into any particular pen in order to make our voices heard and to exercise our civil liberties. And I think, reluctantly, the police have agreed with that. So that's when it gets interesting. Because, of course, the celebratory zones are supposed to be areas where people are going to so-called celebrate the games. And if you're not down there to celebrate, is that going to be a problem for city officials and bylaw enforcement officers who may not be as current on the current bylaw as they should be? And maybe it's going to be a little confusing for some of the police officers out there.
Well, how do you define celebration, really? I think it's kind of a funny notion. I mean,
you're celebrating
your rights to free speech. So.
Well, exactly, and you're celebrating the supreme law of Canada, which is your right to those sorts of things. And if I have a sign that says the Olympics sucks, but I have a happy face on it, am I celebrating? I think so, in our own way. And I think what you'll see with the street festival on the 12th is people will be showing a different kind of celebration, a different kind of festivity, a different kind of community than the very artificial one that the Olympics represents. And you'll see that intermingled in the streets of Vancouver, and I'm hoping that the police will respect that we all have rights to do that and not create a confrontation. My concern is that they, as some of their brethren elsewhere, may see that as a threat and may choose to do something as foolish as they did in Seattle or Quebec City, which I don't think any of us would like to see. And therefore, I have to say that I think what happens on that day and the day after, it really rests in their hands. They can choose to make it a calm outcome that perhaps is embarrassing for the city for some reasons, and certainly embarrassing for the IOC, which, you know, they will see this as spoiling their market image. But on the other hand, it would be very good for all of us if the police were calm and didn't overreact. If they do overreact, I don't know what happens.
Mm. Well, it'll all be on camera, because apparently there's 1,000 security cameras all over town that have been turned on. Do you know more about these? Who's filming this and what happens with all that data?
The security cameras are under the control of the security forces, so they are monitoring them, and they've already begun to do so, and they will be monitoring throughout the games, ostensibly to check for any threats to games venues or athletes or VIPs or things like that. The problem with those, of course, is they don't necessarily go away after the games, and we now know that many of them will probably remain. So, like other Olympic cities, and Jacques Rogge, the president of the IOC, clearly said this when he said that one of the legacies you get from the games is increased security. And what he meant, of course, was exactly that you have increased levels of police surveillance and cameras. And if you go to, for example, London, England, you can't walk into any kind of public place without having cameras aimed at you from every direction. And I think that's going to be one of the negative legacies of the games, is that we are going to sacrifice a lot of our privacy and our personal freedoms. And had that legislation, as originally proposed, stood up, we would have sacrificed far more. And in fact, there are two pieces of two very nasty provincial acts that are also very problematic from a civil liberties perspective. One of them reinforced the city's bylaw enforcement capabilities, and the other one was with the so-called Assistance to Shelter Act, which we call the Kidnapping Act, which basically allowed the police to take people against their will to shelter.
And you've been an outspoken critic of the games for right since the start, before we're even talking about getting a bid. And with just 10 days to the games, are your worst fears coming true?
Well, it's turned out to be much the way I had unfortunately envisioned it, and it's not because I have particular telepathic powers, but because the past history of games pretty much leads in this direction. The only thing I didn't predict was that they would create a total financial mess out of the Athletes' Village, but that's because I didn't know how Millennium, the company that actually was the lead company in the village, how they were financed. Had I known they had gone to a hedge fund, I probably could have predicted that financial meltdown. I thought they were actually going to make money, and so it surprised me that they messed it up so badly. But in terms of civil liberties, that's par and parcel. For past games, environmental destruction, the same thing, cost overruns, insane cost overruns, that happens all the time.
So all this has been documented in other games, but
people
don't think somehow if it's happened before, it's going to happen here.
Yeah, it's precisely correct. This has been seen time and time again. It's not surprising that any of this is happening. I think it's maybe surprising to some people here in British Columbia and in Vancouver, because they thought somehow we were going to be different when we had our games. And yet what had been set in motion was exactly the same sort of thing that people in Athens and Torino and Beijing and everywhere else that's had an Olympic Games in the last 20 years has experienced. It's much the same sort of thing. It's almost like a cookie cutter. The same stuff happens because the IOC demands this rigid obedience to their particular set of goals and values. And cities kowtow, and they do exactly what they're told. And they pass pieces of legislation that they might otherwise not do. And they act in ways they might not otherwise do.
And what do you think about the final cost for security? Do you think they'll be much higher than it's even predicted at the moment?
I do. I think it'll probably be much higher. I don't think we'll ever know. I don't think there's any way to find out. I think the different agencies have so many pockets to take the money out of that we will never find out where they took it, and they'll take it out of cookie and donut jars, and they'll take it out of little slush funds for this, that, and the other thing, and we'll probably never be able to track it down. And I don't think Sheila Fraser, the federal auditor general, or our current provincial auditor general, will be able to figure it out in a million years. And that, again, that's past history of past games, where typically the people who are empowered to try and figure out what these things cost can never quite do their jobs, because the information either vanishes or doesn't exist or gets mysteriously burned up or something like that. And I think if you said the security costs would be double what we know about, I wouldn't be surprised. But again, we'll probably never know.
And I guess you'll be busy in the next 2 weeks going to lots of protests and events and things like that?
I will. My primary role during the protests is as a medic, and I'll be helping to coordinate the medics, and we'll be operating a clinic and have street medics out there to help the protesters and make sure we can do the best we can to possibly keep them safe, and as safe as they can be, and help anyone who might get hurt or even just be cold or hungry or whatever we can do to help out.
And your budget's much less than $1 billion, is it, to keep people safe?
Sadly, yes. Sadly, quite a bit less than $1 billion.
Okay, well, thanks so much for speaking with us this evening, Chris, and helping us make sense of all the things that are happening in our town at the moment.
It's been my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Chris Shaw. He's a local anti-Olympic activist and the author of Five Ring Circus: Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games.